welcome. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, there's a little chat room in there. But you know, what's interesting is chat rooms normally go off topic, and I kind of do as well. And I've found that what's interesting is that when you're doing conspiracy research or having conversations about it, staying quote-unquote on topic actually becomes almost an infrequent impossibility because of the many, many eclectic little thingies that come together in order to actually comprise said topic. And before I go to my guest, I just wanted to read out something my Facebook status this morning. I believe I will not be totally free from the various eclectic forms of choice restrictions we suffer until we're all free. The reason for my activism is not to free myself, nor my country. It's simply the right thing to do. I may never see a free world in my lifetime, but I am driven to do what's right regardless of my level of success. Demonize me, imprison me, poison me, kill me. It matters not. My rage and sense of injustice has now been inflamed and cannot be put out in this life or the next. Bring it on. That's the level of sacrifice I expect for everybody who wants to do something worthwhile in this movement. Speaking of people who do something worthwhile, my very special guest, Douglas Dietrich. Welcome to the program.
Hey, it's great to be here, Mr. Eastwood, as always, with our fantastic audience worldwide through American Freedom Radio out of Texas, but you're broadcasting out of New Zealand, and I, of course, am in the Republic of San Francisco, which is part of the United States strictly by geography. So we've got a truly international call going here, and glad that we've got this hour in which to make it happen. So thank you very much for this opportunity.
Now, today we wanted to discuss Desert Storm, which you actually participated in. It's an anniversary of some description, isn't it?
That's quite right. There's been a lot of anniversaries associated with that operation 22 years ago that I've been talking about lately on my own program, which, of course, is Critical Omissions on Tuesdays and Saturday Night Firing Lines on Saturday nights. And those are both 10 to midnight Eastern Standard Time, and people can access the audio archives on YouTube, and they can get some more details. We can only cover so much in an hour, but people who want to access the audio archives, just look up Douglas Dietrich on YouTube and the Critical Omissions or Saturday Night Firing Lines. Otherwise, you can listen to me live through freedomslips.com, www.freedomslips.com, as in from freedom's lips to your ears, and we take it from there.
Okay, now, Desert Storm, as far as I am aware, was just a complete hoax fabrication in terms of the reason why they were invaded. So the allegation was that Iraq had invaded Kuwait, which technically they did. But what is not revealed to people is that the United States actually encouraged them to do it. And in fact, Iraq even asked, you know, would you retaliate if we invaded Kuwait? And they're like, nah, go ahead, bro.
Yeah. No, it was very much along that level of understanding. To put this into perspective for you, one of the things, this is going to sound very strange, but it's all connected because we live in a strange world and it's a very connected world. But it goes back, for my experience, I was personally in Baghdad in 1988, the summer of 88, which was, of course, the last year of the Gulf War I, which was al-Iraq versus Iran. And at that period of time, al-Iraq had been in its eighth year of warfare with the Iranians. Their army was one of the largest in the world for that reason. This was the Middle East's version of World War I. Both sides had lost over 1 million men in the field. And the war was grinding down to a stalemate, which was at that point intolerable. Something had to give. And I, in San Francisco, was in the middle of my vocational institutional vocational version of high school. This was not a classical high school, but a vocational institute where people were learning a trade so that they could be employed as soon as they graduated. Now, San Francisco at that point in history was the pornography capital of the world. It was a totally different world back then. We did not have computer graphics in any way, shape, or form that people understand today. What we had were comics that people actually drew. So I was a major in commercial illustration, and my income was coming through the illustration of pornographic comics. Now, I myself was under 18 years of age, but I was illustrating for adult fantasies. The I was known to be doing this at the Presidio Military Base. My high school teacher, of course, Gary Willard Hambright, was later on convicted when I turned him in for keeping his child pornography on site, the San Francisco Unified School District property, because he had no home. He was a Southern Baptist minister without a pulpit, so he lived in a church and couldn't keep his stash there. He kept it on site, the school, as art references. And so all of that was going on, and the editor of the Star Presidian, the military base newspaper where he worked, taking care of the child daycare center, and where I worked as a librarian's aide, we all knew each other, and the editor of the Star Presidian said, "Hey, Douglas, the Iraqis are looking for propagandists to draw propaganda posters about Iranian atrocities against their prisoners of war. So we have a lot of consulates here," and that's because the United Nations had been established at the Presidio Military Base of San Francisco in 1942, 3 weeks, 3 days after Pearl Harbor on January 1st. So he said, "Why don't you go to one of the Iraqi consulates? They're sweating in oil money, and they'd be happy to pay for your flight over there and get you set up." And I said, "That's a great idea. It would be great for the job resume." So I went to the Iraqi consulate, and before I knew it, I was in Baghdad. Now, I happened to be in Baghdad on the same day that the USS Samuel Roberts was escorting oil tankers through the Persian Gulf and hit an Iranian ocean-going mine, and basically was severely damaged, if not sunk. And the Americans responded by shelling two Iranian oil platforms that were being used for fire control. And the Iranians were incensed. They sent out a fleet to retaliate, and the largest naval battle in modern history, which you've never heard of, took place. This was called Operation Praying Mantis. At the end of that battle, the Americans sank no less than two or three full-fledged Iranian naval warships and about six to nine suicide speedboats. So this took place, and the Iranians responded with the first use of a civilian airliner as a weapon of war. The Iranians responded by launching a Iran Air Flight 655. And Iran Air Flight 655 was launched out of a airport that was used for both civilian and military purposes, which was why they were able to get away with it. And it came out of that airport straight towards the USS Vincennes. And the USS Vincennes at that point in time was a very expensive missile cruiser, kept firing communiques electronically towards this incoming plane that was coming at it at waterline level, right above the waves, straight towards its superstructure. And if it had hit the hull of the ship and the plane would both have disintegrated. And so it was obviously in a kamikaze dive. And the captain had no choice but, after multiple communiques, to shoot it down. And when he shot it down, everyone in the Persian Gulf in area, all of Bahrain, Kuwait, the Qatar, the various Persian Gulf crucial sheikdoms or emirates, everybody was able to see on camera all of these hundreds of naked male bodies floating in the water with their hands tied behind their backs. And we all knew that civilian jetliner had been filled with Iraqi prisoners of war. So it was a situation where I called back home to the States. It was the 4th of July weekend of 1988. And I called my girlfriend at the time. I called my family. I called my coworkers. I said, did you see that footage? And everybody said, yes. And if you ask many people now, some people who have good memories will recall it when you describe that scene to them. That showed in the United States for literally 24 hours and was never seen again. And after that, the United States said, oh, Iran Air Flight 655 was filled with women and children on a pilgrimage to Al-Makka. And we shot it down, and we are going to remunerate the Iranians millions and millions of dollars for what we did. Absolutely bizarre. No one could understand the politics behind this without looking at the Iran-Contra scandal. And the Iran-Contra scandal at the time was such that the Americans had made a deal with the devil concerning the Mullahkrats, or the Shiite theocrats, the medievalists who ran Iran. And they made a deal with them, and at that point in time, they had essentially decided that they were going to switch sides against Iraq, which had been defending Israel, had been defending the West against Iran for 8 years.
Now, when you say Mullahkrats, are those who rule by the use of mullah?
I like that. That's good. The mullahs are the Iranian theocrats, the Shiite medievalist imams who rule by religious doctrine. And so they had essentially run Iran to the ground. The difference between them was that they were, of course, religious fundamentalists who viewed the Soviet Union, the United States, and Israel as all part of the same axis of evil. Now, there goes an interesting axis of evil for you, or a different perception of one. And what happened was the Iraq's form of government was Arab socialism. It was a Ba'athist fascist party that had taken on the collectivization of Stalinism. So their version of fascism was heavily influenced by communist socialism. They were very secular, and the Americans found them quite threatening. One of the things the Americans found most threatening was that when the mullahs took over Iran and the Shah fell and had to go into exile, all of these women who lived under the Shah's secular regime, which was considered an Aryan regime, by the way, the Shah's wife was German, and the Shah declared himself the king of all Aryans. The name Iran is simply the Greek word for Aryan. So we're dealing with a very complicated set of politics most people in the West aren't even aware of. But because the Shah was very fascistic in his classical sense, he allowed a lot of progress for women in the sense of getting them educated, in the sense of industrialization, in the sense of modernization. And so you had all kinds of women in professions that was an exception in all the Muslim world. And the result was when the mullahs took over, they told all of these female MDs and CEOs and CPAs and professors that if they continued to practice, they would be executed. And so all of these women had to flee Iran. They crossed the border, many of them, and they went to exile in Iraq, where Saddam Hussein was able to supply them with tanks, helicopters, whatever they wanted. And through that, all of these Amazons and headscarves formed what was known as the Mujahideen Yelhalka. And Mujahideen simply means freedom fighter in the Farsi language. And the language of Farsi extends all the way through Afghanistan into Tajikistan.
Yeah. I thought it meant holy warriors.
Yes. In Arabic, the term holy warrior would be Ghazi. But in Farsi, Mujahideen means like freedom fighter, but it usually has a religious connotation. In terms of holy warriors, you're thinking more like the Taliban. Taliban translates or literally or transliterates into the term seminarian like a Bible student, only in this case a student of the Quran. The question, of course, would be, gee, the Taliban, these seminarians, where do all these Bible students, these students of the Quran, get all these laser-guided rockets and these Abrams M1 battle tanks and these Hind helicopters? Gee, that's a, you know, how is it that these seminarians get all that? You know, that's an incredible situation. That's because the Taliban was a foreign invasion of Afghanistan. People don't realize that there's no such thing as an Afghan Taliban. All of the Taliban were Pakistani. That the Taliban was a Pakistani ISI. That's the Pakistani version of the CIA. That was a Pakistani ISI all-out invasion of Afghanistan. And the native Afghans underneath what became known as the Northern Front, which was led by a man
Hold on, Douglas.
Sure.
We're coming to break now. See, I always thought Taliban was a prohibition on television. We'll be right back after.
They prohibited badminton, by the way. Yeah, they wouldn't let anyone play badminton.
Wow, I didn't like the shuttlecock then. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. By the way, you may have heard the ads on American Freedom Radio that I made with a collection of listeners about how we need your support in order to keep the network going, for one, and secondly, to expand it. It's in desperate need of new equipment, and the easiest way to do that is to either go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click on the new donate banner that we just had installed last night in the wee small hours of the morning. So I would encourage people, if you have the capacity to make a monthly donation, there is an option there for $100 US a month, which I thought would be a brilliant move, because that gives them something to work from that's significant in terms of contributions to just keep the bills paid, you know, because it's actually really expensive. I've only really found out last night, just to pay for all the electricity, for all the gear that they've got there, and even to run something like 11 different radio shows that they've got on this network that they're just running out of their little house there. So, you know, please go to the AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click on the donate banner. And my rule is, take care of yourself and family first before you think about donating to me. And I'd like to add the proviso, donate to American Freedom Radio first before you think about donating to me also. Along the same vein of ruthless promotion and monetary compensation, we also have a group of DVDs, which are in fact relevant to this topic of the Middle East and things of that nature, which Douglas is now going to plug for himself. Douglas, proceed.
Thank you, sir. That was very graceful. I couldn't have done better. With that incredibly subtle segue, we have a DVD set of basically 100 of these sets are left. We're trying to get rid of them before the Asian Lunar New Year, which Mr. Eastwood might be somewhat familiar with, being on the Oceanian side of the world. And the Asian Lunar New Year is far more celebrated by the Chinese and the Vietnamese in this day and age. The Sinitic cultures are the Sinoviet cultures than it is by the Japanese and the Koreans. Unfortunately, but the Japanese and the Koreans also hold to it. So the correct term is not Chinese New Year, but Asian Lunar New Year's. And that begins on February 10th. So before we exit the Year of the Dragon, we would like to clean our house of these 100 DVD sets. They are pertinent to topic, and they are pertinent to many topics. One of them, Roswell and the Rising Sun, we are going to analog into text format. We are in the process of doing so. So we are not going to keep that particular DVD set. However, it is very near and dear to my heart and very important because my mother died as a direct result of producing that DVD. It was a lecture that was delivered at the Sacramento, which is the capital of the state of California, MUFON, our Mutual UFO Network chapter. the young lady who you'll see in the DVD, who has since changed her name for security reasons, was Cynthia Siegel, and Cynthia Siegel used to be the producer for UFO Connection, which was a Sacramento-based television series on, of course, ufology. She was going to interview me for that television series, and they took her series off the air. Didn't just cancel an episode. They took her series off the air. And as a result, she felt it was very important to get this news out. We set up a production that is very hurried. We didn't even have time to put up a movie screen, but it's high def, so the images are still visible. And due to the security threats we got, we didn't even advertise, but it turned out to be the most attended MUFON conference that they've ever had. And they were able to even move to a different higher grade venue after that. We were essentially in a restaurant franchise conducting this. But it came out very well, and the end result was, unfortunately, I came home to find my mother dying. And this was due to a bit of high assassination technology. I brought her to the hospital immediately, and her main aorta to her heart was dissected in two places, as the MDs said. They had never seen anything like it. It was like a laser scalpel, a surgical scalpel, had been taken to cleanly dissect her veins so that she would die in the utmost agony. This wasn't a rupture caused by somebody who was just having a high blood pressure problem and worn thin arteries that rupture and burst, because she would have died within seconds. This was something that was sliced, and they said there was no bruises, there was no open cuts, there was no point of entry. They had no idea how it was done. So this was something that was unheard of to them, and she spent a month dying in absolute agony while the blood pooled into her digestive system and everywhere else in her body and her chest cavity. So that's the price that I paid for getting the truth out with Roswell and the Rising Sun. It's directly connected to the other DVD, which is Satan's Crusaders, which talks about the United States Army and its infestation by the Satanic Chaplaincy. I talk about my almost a decade's worth of liaising under orders with the Satanic Chaplain of the United States Army, Colonel Michael Aquino. And Colonel Aquino, of course, was formerly a member of the First Church of Satan. And I have photos in that DVD you will not find anywhere else. I was educated at City College of San Francisco, which is about to close, by the way. In City College of San Francisco, I majored in criminology and criminal psychology. Also took several courses in forensic photography. The instructors who taught me forensic photography were very elderly. They were just about to retire. These were the same instructors who taught Magus Anton Zandor LaVey, the Black Pope of the First Church of Satan, his trade in forensic photography, so he could become a San Francisco police photographer, and that's how he evaded the Korean War era draft. So those same men who taught him his trade taught me mine, and I was able to use that skill to take photographs of both human and animal victims of satanic sacrifice after they were killed. So those forensic photos are available in that DVD. You will not find them anywhere else. Now, the reason this is connected with our present topic is, of course, Colonel Aquino, the Satanic Chaplain of the U.S. Army, served in Vietnam in 1968, and it's connected with both Roswell and Desert Storm, because he was brought back from his service in Vietnam as a psychological warfare expert. He was able to prove the cost effectiveness of the occult while he was in theater in Vietnam, and he was recalled with the incident of Sergeant Melvin Brown beginning to talk to his family about Roswell during the moon landings of 1969. And so they brought him back and said, this is still an Army matter. There was no Air Force at the time in 1947. Roswell Army Airfield belonged to the U.S. Army, so we want you to take care of this. That's how he instigated the entire Roswell cover-up with a satanic bent to it. He literally went to the town of Roswell and told them, this one-horse S-hole is going to dry up and blow away and wither away because President Lyndon Baines Johnson, our commander-in-chief, has ordered the transfer of Roswell Air Force Base to Texas, his home state, to keep his electorate happy. And you people will be left with no income unless you make a deal with the devil, with me. And they agreed to it, and he said, every time one of you dies, I want you to tell everybody that you saw aliens on a deathbed confession. So every time one of those seniors in Roswell dies, They're surrounded by all these people who are the town elders waiting like vultures to keep the high school funded, to keep all the museums going, the alien tourism going. And these people sign this confession, and every time Lieutenant Colonel Aquino, at that time he was a lieutenant colonel, had a pegboard, he'd place one more soul consigned to hell, one more soul signed over to Satan. He was just like, it was the biggest joke in the world to him. He was creating the Lourdes and the Medjugorje of a new religion, a new UFO cult in America. Well, how it connects to Desert Storm is just like in Vietnam, we had all kinds of senior officers who had served in World War II. That's why Americans lost the Vietnam War. They were fighting the Vietnamese as if they were confronting the Germans or the Soviets on the battlefields of Europe as in mechanized warfare as opposed to fighting a guerrilla war. And in Desert Storm, all of our high officers were Vietnam veterans. Most of these men had served in Vietnam. One of them was Colonel Michael Aquino. And Colonel Michael Aquino, that was his last war. He served in Operation Desert Shield and Operation Desert Storm, just as I did. We were in different branches of service at that time. He was an officer, and he was Army. I was an enlisted man, and I was Marine Corps. So I was not in any way, shape, or form connected with him at that point. But he was about 44, 45 years of age at that time, which is exactly the age I am now. I am now about 46 years of age. So he was as old back then as I am now. And so he was still in his prime. I like to think of myself as still in my prime. I don't feel it. And so that is how all of this connects. So I do invite all of you to hit www.douglasdietrich.com. Douglas is spelled with one S. Dietrich is spelled just like the famous actress Marlene Dietrich. And if you're too young to remember her, just put the words diet and rich together. So just go to douglasdietrich.com. And we have these on sale, too, for the price of one until Asian Lunar New Year. So get the last 100 before they're all gone.
Now, I asked you over the break, you know how one of the reasons why people went into Iraq the second time is because of WMDs rather than STDs, weapons of mass destruction. And I was just wondering, you know, were there actually any, like, I know for a fact that there was never reported that we found any, and I know that everybody reckons it was a huge lie just to get it in there, but now I'm wondering, I wonder if they actually did find some, but they just gave it to their CIA-sponsored terrorists or something like that for use on the United States later. I have no idea. I don't know. I'm just firing out random BS here, basically. I wanted to get your
That's great, and this might carry us over the break at the bottom of the hour if we have one, so I'll definitely get into that right now. I do want to close off with what I was saying about the Mujahideen El Halqa, and I will address that because it's very important and affected me very privately, very personally, as well as many men, thousands and thousands of them. And the point is, as a matter of fact, tens of thousands of men died due to WMDs in the what Americans think of as Gulf War I. But the reality was Operation Desert Shield and Operation Desert Storm were Gulf War II. Gulf War I was Iran versus Iraq for 8 years. Gulf War II is divided into Bush War I and Bush War II. So Gulf War II is subdivided into those two phases. But
I'd always thought that Tiger Woods fought in the Gulf War.
Well, what happened with the Mujahideen al-Halqa was they were a tremendous threat to that fossilized cold warrior sitting in the White House, George Bush Sr., because the Mujahideen al-Halqa was, first of all, an all-female army. They were the most educated army in the history of mankind ever to hit the field. They were all MDs, attorneys at law, CPAs, CEOs. It was an incredibly well-educated and well-trained force. They adapted easy to using high-tech weapons, tanks, and helicopters very quickly, and they scored the highest kill ratios of all of Saddam Hussein's forces against the mullahs of Iran. And they were all set to roll into Tehran and throw the mullahs into the Caspian Sea. And what happened was, at that point in time, they were identified as communists. They were very Marxian in their ideology. And, of course, Saddam Hussein was also a Stalinist. I never met the man personally, and one of the reasons why was because during that period of crisis, he had conducted a pilgrimage not to Al-Makkah or Al-Madinia, but rather to Stalin's birthplace in the Caucasus in Georgia and to his final resting place in Moscow. where he is on display. So he had statues of Stalin all over the place. His troops were trained in Soviet-style tactics and carried AK-47s, whereas the mullahs, Pazdarin, or Republican Guard of the Iranians, carried German Heckler and Koshis and machine guns, H&Ks. And so we have two very different sponsor states for both different cultures, and the end result was the Americans identified Al-Iraq as a communist satellite state of Mikhail Gorbachev's Soviet Union. So they said, we've got to wipe these people out, because if those feminists take over Iran, who is dealing with us through this Iran-Contra scandal, then we're, our entire Iran-Contra plan gets destabilized, and these women wind up setting up a communist Iran, and then you've got a kind of Stalinist state in Iraq, communist state in Iran, both of them kind of allied to the Soviet Union. The Americans said this was the ultimate domino nightmare theory. So that was the reason for Bush War One. So when Bush went in, he fought it Korean War style, where he basically considered it like a limited war. He had to do it Korean War style, where you had 22 nations underneath the United Nations umbrella. He started this multinational coalition, and we went into Al-Kuwait, and there were at that time most definitely WMDs that were sold to Saddam Hussein by the United States. And at that time he had taken all of these chemical fertilizers, converted them into cyclosarine nerve gas, which he had deployed against the Kurds and killed thousands and thousands of Kurdistani minority peoples. And their major storage facility was in Kamisaya. And at Kamisaya, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers made one of the few penetrative invasions into Al-Iraq in Operation Desert Storm. And they blew that facility. And at that point, the Marine Corps had already plowed all the way through Al-Kuwait. We went straight through the minefields, and all of the frontline Marines were exposed to genocidal-level nerve agents. So I and all these other Marines, you can see these photos. They're rather famous, or were at the time, that were published in Newsweek magazine. You see all of these jarheads wearing mop gear, mind you, chemical warfare gear, but their hoods are all off, and they're looking at these technicolor mushroom clouds in the distance. That's the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers blowing the facilities at Kamisaya, and all of us idiots with our hoods off are sucking it into our lungs like human vacuum cleaners. And the whole reason for that was the mop gear is charcoal-lined rubber. It's 110 degrees on the desert on a cool day, and we were losing as many pounds of water weight in as many minutes with our hoods and our mop gear on. So we had a choice of just dying of dehydration or sucking in the nerve gas and dying later. Most of us chose to die later. We all did, as a matter of fact. We had been dropping.
Well, hold on, Douglas. We're coming to break now. The feminist T-shirt that says the only Bush that I trust is my own comes to mind. We'll be right back.
People, wherever you roam.
Welcome back.
And admit that the waters around you have grown.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's our final segment with the illustrious, indomitable, and inimitable Douglas Dietrich. And we were talking over the break about how Sarah has had a bit of an ear infection. You know, when you wear earmuffs, ladies and gentlemen, and it kind of creates a breeding ground for bacteria inside your head. So she's been laid up on the couch for the last 2-3 days and can't go to work because of a infection that occurred because she was going to work. That's a real pain in the ass. I'd really love to be able to kind of have enough income so that I could support both of us so that she wouldn't actually have to go to work and, you know, she'd help out around the house and help me with some of the work that I have to do here and that kind of thing. It's just not possible at the moment unless people start donating huge, huge quantities of money to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com, which I encourage. Please go to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com and stick us out a nice wee little donation. Preferably not so wee and not so little, and or a subscription for between $1 and $5 or $10 or $20 a month. So give us something to work on day to day. All right, now my very special guest, Douglas Dietrich. We wanted to go over that weapons of mass destruction in Iraq question and whether or not there even were any, because what I heard was that during Gulf War One, or Bush Gulf War One, as you kind of is there
Bush War One,
Bush War. Sounds like some kind of conflict that would happen in outback Australia. And what happened was, as far as I've heard, is that Marines and Rangers would find these facilities that are stocked full of all of these weapons and chemical agents and things like that, and they were shocked at what they saw on all the boxes made in the USA, because the USA had been busy selling weapons to them for a long time, and they were like, oh my God, we can't take these weapons out of here. Because then all the news cameras and everything like that would see us taking out US-made weapons out of all these Iraqi weapons facilities after we've invaded them, and completely make us look like a bunch of criminal...
like exactly lines. What they are, yeah.
It would make us look like what we are. So instead of owning up and just admitting who you are and what you do as a US administration, not putting anything on the US individuals or soldiers or anything like that, they had no real part in this. They detonated the weapons bunkers, and you know, it's like, here's the choice. Okay, we've got a choice. We can either come clean and be honest and take our licks from in terms of public relations, or we can poison every single soldier that we duped into serving us for the rest of their fracking life and create a new disease that never existed called Gulf War Syndrome.
But that was one factor of it. As a matter of fact, what had happened at Camp Messiah, that was the biggest blow of the facilities where most of these weapons of mass destruction were gathered. That was the core of it, and let's call it the central star of the constellation of whatever other storage sites they may have found throughout Yalirak. It was in the southerly region. It was very close to the Kuwaiti border. And that's why all of us who had gone through Kuwait were able to see it and literally see the results of the explosion. And so the reason that they blew those bunkers was exactly the reason you stated, to hide the trail of receipts, which went back to companies such as Halliburton and major chemical industries in the United States. So we paid the price. Now, they were claiming, this is people might ask who are war geeks or claim they were in the military, or were in the military and didn't see crap. People might ask, why didn't we just inject ourselves with atropine? Okay, well, you inject yourself with atropine when you know you've been sucking in chemical weapons. What people don't realize is that the United States military ordered us not to inject atropine because they were telling us we were not inhaling chemical weapons. They were saying all that funny smell that you're inhaling, and you don't really smell too much of anything with cyclosarine nerve gas coming at that distance. Basically, they were just telling us we were free from exposure. By the way, we had all kinds of equipment that was supposed to sense this. We also had dogs. There were 500,000 men in Operation Desert Shield. There were 41,000 women. And there were 35,000 dogs that had been brought in country. And the dogs were rendered useless by a totally different phenomena that hopefully we might have a few moments to get into. But as for the weapons themselves, they ultimately didn't work. It was on June 21st of 1996, which was years later, that the Pentagon had made an announcement that shattered what little credibility they had on medical engineers on medical and engineering subjects. They had for half a decade been insisting that no one serving in the Gulf War had been exposed to chemical or biological weapons. They were forced to recant, and tens of thousands of Allied soldiers, they admitted, were exposed to nerve gas after the Iraqi ammunition depot containing chemical weapons was blown at Camp Messiah. And the detectors picked up no sign of chemical release that day, but it turned out the detection equipment appeared to have been faulty. By the way, I believe that this was an entire lie, that the detection equipment worked, whereas the dogs didn't, but they simply did not admit to it. Either that or it was intentionally sabotaged by operatives so that they wouldn't have to admit to it. And the reason why was they didn't want anyone to know about the trail of receipts of which you speak. So we all paid the price for that. And over the years, very few people died in the Gulf War. The amount of fatalities in Operation Desert Storm was something like 300 to 500, which is incredibly small for a military operation, except for a scattered few Marines during an Iraqi spoiler attack at Al-Kafia, and except for about 8 or 9 soldiers killed by a stray Scud missile. Every single one of those men was killed by friendly fire. Every single one of those men was killed by another American. But the rest, tens of thousands have died after Operation Desert Storm because of exposure to cyclosarine nerve gas, which I was exposed to, or to depleted uranium. And the point was that I was lucky enough where I was dishonorably discharged, which is a whole other story in and of itself, which we could speak of in the near future. But the point was, because of that, I had no access to the VA. And as a result, I had to pay for private doctors at UCSF, which were willing to do experimental surgery, which ultimately went into my lungs, scraped clear all the blisters caused by the chemical weapons, and stapled my lungs to my rib cage. Until that point in time, my lungs had collapsed 7 times, and I was set to either be intubated the rest of my life with chest tubes coming out, walking around with a machine, or I could die. So I underwent experimental surgery. Didn't pay for it because it cost too much, and that's why I have no credit. But as opposed to that, the other Marines who suffered what they called DRI, D-R-I, disabling respiratory illnesses, got access to the VA, and they're all dead. So I'm at 30% lung capacity, but I'm way ahead of the game in that regard. So the reason for the dogs not working is because of what a phenomena that no one was acknowledging in country. We had a phenomenon which the Arabic popular culture acknowledged, known as the Desert Ghouls. And what had happened was we spent 9 months setting up for Operation Desert Storm in what was known as Operation Desert Shield. And it was in the first few days of Operation Desert Shield on August 7th of 1990 that King Fahd agreed to accept Allied troops in the House of Saud. This was within days of Saddam Hussein's invasion of Al.
Wasn't this after, I think, some kind of U.S. official came to the House of Saud and said, hey, look, there's Iraqi military massing at your borders. You know, I've seen the satellite images and everything. And the House of Saud goes, really? Could you show us the satellite images? And they goes, no, you're going to have to trust us and allow us to put massive new United States bases in your territory instead.
Well, the House of Saud is just it's a horror story in and of itself, and they're a horrible group of people in the royal dynasty. At that time in history, the Womanis, or the Gulf Kingdom, or Emirate of Woman, was all of their domestic servants. And what happened was when the King of Oman went into the House of Saud, they all treated him like he was dirt. They left him in rooms alone with babies that were wailing, that needed their diapers changed, and were saying, oh, hey, why didn't you change the diapers? Or everywhere he went, people would shove brooms and dustbins in his face and say, hey, don't forget to clean up before you leave. And he went back to Oman and he said to all of his domestic workers that were still in the House of Saud, all of you come home within 3 months or you lose your Womani citizenship. And if they lost their citizenship, that would render them nationless, and in the House of Saud, that legally would render them slaves under other Quranic law, under Sharia. So they all left, went back home to Oman, and that's how all of these Filipinos and Filipinas began working in the House of Saud as their domestic servants. That all happened during that period of Operation Desert Shield that we were there. But at the time, the only honorable professions, as far as I'm concerned, were like police and military forces. None of them otherwise work. Basically, a foreign population does all the work in the House of Saud otherwise. And during that period of time of Desert Shield, after Kuwait was invaded, King Fahd agreed to have troops in there. That was on the same day I was dishonored. What happened was there was a girls' dormitory on fire. We were on leave. We had no weapons. And the Mutawwa'een, Saudi religious police, were nearby. And by the way, is this the end of the whole show? Or?
It is. We've only got about maybe 30 seconds left to go. But I'd like to leave with something from Bill Hicks. He said, oh, Iraq, they've got incredible weapons, incredible weapons. Hell yeah, I know that. We looked at the receipt. But as soon as that check clears, we're going in. What time's the bank open? 8? We're going in at 9. For God and country, and he's a Hitler, and a fetus. Yeah, here you go. Whatever you need. Let's go. Whatever you, the apathetic American docile masses, need to get behind. Here, here's a fetus. Look at it.
Oh, it's a little fetus. Oh, he's a bad man. He's a hit. I hate this man all of a shit.
Douglas Dietrich from DouglasDietrich.com. Thank you very much for incredible, info, really, which basically nobody else really has access to. I wish we could say more, but unfortunately, here's the break.